Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the People Power Politics podcast, brought to you by CEDA, the Center for Elections, Democracy, Accountability and Representation at the University of Birmingham.
Hi, my name is Tim Horton. I am Professor of Comparative and European Politics here at the University of Birmingham, and I'm going to be your host for this particular episode. It is my great pleasure to welcome to this podcast, and indeed to my office in Birmingham, two wonderful speakers and great scholars, Alan Sick from University College London and Philip Kircher from the Leibniz University in Hanover. Great to have you here, guys. Thank you so much for coming and for doing this podcast with us. So Alan Sick, he is Associate Professor in Comparative Politics at the School of Slavonic and East European Studies at the University College London. His research focuses on European electoral and party politics, research methods, and political and social transformation in Central and Eastern Europe. And Philip is lecturer and research fellow in the Department of Political Science at Leibniz University in Hanover. His research focuses on presidential politics, political parties, elections, and comparative constitutional law. So today we are here to talk about Alan and Philip's new book entitled Party People, Candidates and Party Evolution, which was published by Oxford University Press just a few months ago in their Comparative Politics series. So firstly, congratulations, gentlemen, on publishing a very interesting book, and I'm very much looking forward to talking about the book. Now, rather than me give a very long introduction about what the book is about, you're here. So I would just like to start off by asking you, what was the main motivation for writing the book?
Well, thank you, Tim, for inviting us to your office and to the podcast. We have been for many years now studying new political parties and party system change, with a particular focus on Central and Eastern Europe. And when you look around the region and the party systems, then you will see that most of the party systems in the region are incredibly unstable. And what is particularly exciting about the sort of changing landscape of party politics in Eastern Europe is that most of the countries that are the recent EU member states, or relatively recent EU member states, have had one or two elections that have been won by parties that were formed just less than a year before the election. I could mention, you know, Bulgaria, Romania, Slovenia, Slovakia, Estonia, Latvia. I guess the list goes on if you consider very, very popular new political parties. So it's a sort of running theme. But also the change in party systems is not exclusively an East European disease. Similar things have happened, for example, France, least of all, Emmanuel Macron storming the Elysee Palace a few years ago. Also in Italy, you know, starting from the populist oddball Beppe Grillo taking the five-star movement to the government, and not to mention, of course, Forza Italia and the late Silvio Berlusconi, who's the godfather of new party politics in Europe, if you like. But so far, you know, new parties have not assumed executive responsibility in other West European countries, even though party change and innovation is rife.
Yeah, for example, just in my native Germany, we're currently witnessing the birth of a young party, the Alliance of Sarah Wagenknecht, which isn't really new because she, of course, was a co-leader of the Left Party, and she's taken half of the MPs with her. And this is something we see in quite a lot of countries. We've seen this also in Denmark, where we had this great splinters almost that in the end were larger than the original party. But one problem that we find in party research is really that quite often we need to classify parties as either old or new, whereas in reality, they're somewhere in between, they're partially new. And so to borrow a word from or phrase from one of your books with Kevin Deegan Krause, we're really entering a soggy world in terms of party politics. And this is really, probably one of the key motivations as well in how can we deal with this soggy world of new, old, partially new parties, parties that look old but are not parties that look new but are actually old. And while political science has really dealt a lot with party change, it really hasn't fully considered how parties as a whole change. They've really only looked at how parties change in very small different parts. But actually, when we look at political parties, we see that they change all the time. And this then really goes into the theme of evolution that we're looking at. We're looking not at as party change as an instantaneous phenomenon, but something that happens all the time, is continuous. It doesn't go towards a particular aim, but parties do change, and hence we sort of must find new ways in looking at these changing parties.
That's really interesting. And so thinking about this desire to capture and understand change, party change, not just in Central and Eastern Europe, but more broadly, what would you say is the key kind of takeaway message from the book?
I think one key message really is that, again, returning to Macron and his En Marche, this is when you look at the party more closely, then this is actually a partially new party par excellence. And if we accept the fact that some parties are partially new, then obviously you kind of open up the full spectrum. There are some parties that are newer than others. Some parties sort of are more stable than others. So we are dealing with a continuum of party change. And the book essentially suggests ways in which we could look at the party change, the ways in which we could measure the party change. We are looking at various aspects of party change, obviously candidates being the first, or party people more broadly being the first, also captured by the title already. But we're also looking at party leadership change. We are also looking at party policy change. We're also looking at party organizational change, party splitting up or merging, also electoral coalitions forming and also breaking apart, and so on. And in many ways, the book isn't really only a book about political parties or organizational change, because it is more broadly actually a book about evolution. When we were writing the book, we were inspired by evolutionary biology, where since 1970s, there's been a sort of shift away from understanding evolution as a evolution of, you know, bisons or jellyfish as sort of organisms, and focusing much more on the molecular basis of evolution, or the change in the genes. Nowadays, all evolution is described as, or analyzed actually, in terms of, you know, sequencing of the genes and then seeing when the different species actually split. So for us, we are looking again inside these parties, like, you know, evolutionary biologists are looking inside the organisms. We are looking at inside the party. So we are looking at candidates or party people more broadly. But candidates are in many ways a very useful sort of segment of these people to look at. And we conceptualize them as sort of party genes. And even though the selfish gene argument in evolutionary biology is a little bit controversial, because obviously in contrast to organisms or people or individuals, the genes do not have an agency. Genes do not want anything, because obviously they are just molecules. But actually, when we sort of use the analogy in party politics, or actually understanding any organizations, then it's actually quite fascinating to realize that the organizations themselves, they don't have any agency apart from the actual agency of the people inside, because people want things rather than parties, and parties simply do the things. I mean, it's a slightly theoretical, perhaps, discussion, but it's kind of a justification for actually looking at the people in trying to understand what is going on with the parties.
So I think you've answered one question that I was going to ask you about, why picking candidates. You've made a kind of case for that. But I wonder if you can try and explain how you go about operationalizing that. How do you say, okay, that the core of understanding parties and party change is to look at the party people, the title of the book. How do you move, or how did you move in the book from a nice idea to something that's actually operationalizable? Maybe, Philip, I can ask you that question.
Yes, so we do that in thinking about how so-called electoral slates form, because we assume that parties change over time. We can't really assume that one party is the same in one election and in the next. And so we think of slates of candidates as being electoral unit that proposes candidates in a single election. And we think about how these slates form. If we think of traditional stable party, then of course we have an organization around it, and candidates who ran in the last election will now come together with those with whom they ran, maybe recruit a few more, and then they run again in the same form. But we imagined a certain candidate or slate formation game where a candidate decides to run for office and is either approached by a proto-slate of other running mates, or him or herself approaches these and is then either rejected or joins their slate and then hopefully runs in the election. Or a candidate might not ever think about, or a person might not ever think about running for office, but is approached by other running mates and might join in. And this really helps us to then put this approach of candidate-centric view of party evolution into practice.
That's really interesting. So can I ask you, you mentioned right at the beginning this new party in Germany. So I can imagine some people listening to this podcast who maybe don't follow Central and Eastern Europe will be thinking, okay, there's this new party. So maybe take us through the steps as to how you would evaluate the newness of this new political party. How can other political scientists take your method and apply it to this case that isn't in your book, but you have a method to explain it?
Yes, especially for the Sarah Wagenknecht Alliance, we actually see that we have a politician who is very motivated to form her own party, and we can actually see very publicly that she approaches other politicians to join her slate and is quite particular about whom she wants to have run with her. And we can actually look at who these people are, whether they ran for another party before, whether these were very prominent politicians. And I've already said, well, she took some of the MPs of Die Linke, the left party, with her. And we can really say that there's a big overlap between the left party and, well, once the Sarah Wagenknecht party runs for office and we know which candidates there are, we can then see whether these formerly prominent candidates also get a prominent spot on her lists, or whether somebody from further down the electoral lists of Die Linke then also joins the Sarah Wagenknecht party. We call this overlap congruence between parties, and this is also one of, I'd say, major contributions of changing our thinking about parties, because quite often when we want to see how a party did over several elections or want to calculate electoral volatility, we need to very neatly link one party in the last election to a party in the election right now, and just one connection is possible. Whereas with our approach, thinking about these congruences of one party to several parties, or allowing also for new candidates to come in, we can be much more nuanced in calculating our measures.
So essentially what we are doing, it's despite the fact we probably left the impression that it's a very theoretical book, it is not. It's actually very empirical, because it's based on this all lists of candidates in 60 elections from Eastern Europe. But I think the ideas hopefully will also resonate with most other regions in the world. And I don't see any reason why the ideas shouldn't actually, or the methods shouldn't actually work out in other parts of the world. So we basically have the electoral lists for all candidates and all parties, or slates as we call them. And then we're basically comparing them from one election to another, looking at which portion of candidates is from previously existing parties and which portion of the candidates is new. But obviously, we also acknowledge that not all candidates are equal. There are often, you know, party leaders and then people close to the leadership or different leadership positions. So they get a higher weighting in our scores. And there's also, in all elections, there are always, even for the most popular parties, there are also runs who we weigh less heavily in our indices, so as to give the more weight to the people who are more prominent inside these parties. So we are talking about weighted candidate novelty, but also dropout. Mm-hmm. Dropout is almost a mirror image of novelty, but not only. And it's fascinating to see that dropout refers to candidates who weren't running in the following election. And even though there are some genuinely new parties in Eastern Europe where more than 90% of the candidates are new, what doesn't happen as often at all is party disappearing completely. Even parties that, as organizations, sort of completely disbanded, are nowhere to be seen again, they still leave often a typically sort of 25% of the candidates behind who run for different slates in the following election. So it's not quite the mirror image there. I thought it was quite fascinating. Also to see and to understand that people who are already running for the parliament, they have a motivation to stay in politics. And obviously, if the party disappears, or sometimes they decide to actually call it a day for the organization, they find other ways in which they can be still involved.
So as you both know, I also follow the party politics, particularly in Central and Eastern Europe. And I can say that it's sometimes quite a challenge to collect the data upon which we make our kind of arguments. And I mean, one of the most impressive aspects of your book is the data collection. And I wondered actually if you could say something about how you managed to go about doing this in a way to collect robust data on candidate lists from all of these parties, many of which, you know, fly by nights. They're here today, gone tomorrow. Maybe, you know, there's very little trace of them a decade or so afterwards. So how did you go about doing that? And maybe I could bolt onto that a broader question about the challenges of writing a data-driven book like this one about party politics, not just in Central and Eastern Europe, but rooted in that region?
Yeah, actually, collecting all these candidates' lists was probably one of the biggest challenges in the beginning. There were projects before that tried to collect data on candidates, but then stored them in a format that sort of cut off half the names and wasn't quite usable for our purposes, or data was only available for parties that were elected. So what we did was first online, going through all the websites of the electoral commissions, going through the archived websites, requesting PDFs and turning them into spreadsheets. There was quite a lot of manual labor involved in making sure that all these lists were correct. And what I think we shouldn't underestimate is the amount of qualitative knowledge needed to actually work with candidate data. For example, we found out that something that we first classified as a spelling error in the name of a Hungarian candidate was rather a suffix that indicated that this was the wife of somebody, but it was simply one of the many ways in which Hungarian women can change their name after marriage. And I think this qualitative knowledge is also what really drives our more illustrative examples in the book. We went through so many news articles, so many academic publications in, well, the whole range of languages of the countries covered in our book to find out who party leaders were in the early 90s or how they changed, whether they were active before or not, to see whether we maybe missed a prominent candidate who suddenly appeared at the top of the party list. And really, even though it seems it's a very data quantitative book, in many ways it's also a very qualitative book, because you need a lot of qualitative insights into these countries, into the party systems and the politics, to really make the analysis work.
In many ways, yes, we did have to dig really deep with some of the names and then some of the parties. But the part of the ambition of the book, or the whole approach, is actually to devise a method for understanding party development that can rely on something as simple as just lists of candidates that are much more easier to get hold of. Many other sort of full overviews of what happened to these parties. Like in Lithuania over the years, you've had four or five, if not more, parties called something Labour or Social Democratic. And most people, unless you are an expert on Social Democratic and Labour parties in Lithuania, you would have very little idea what actually went on there. Are they related to each other? It looks like the names are very similar, but, you know, often the similar names hide quite different beasts. So what this approach is actually suggesting is that you just need the candidate names. And now we've checked that the system or the method works, or the algorithm that we outlined works, we can actually draw, and there are examples of these evolutionary trees of political parties in the nine East European countries that are automatically extracted from just the lists of names. And it's not perfect, but we can go back to many, many years, and it will still, if we have the candidate lists, we don't really need to know very much about the individual parties or what happened. Was there a splinter? Was there a merger? Who left the... We will get some sort of understanding of the dynamics in party systems just having these lists. And it can be used in any country of the world, any period from which we can find, you know, maybe in the archives, the candidate lists. So that's part of the attractiveness of the index, at least for us, is that it can be extended well beyond the region.
I would like to come back to the wider points later on, but maybe let's also step back and look at your measure and how it's used to generate volatility scores, because I think in some respects quite a lot of political scientists will find that is the one of the most important parts of the book. So I just wonder, make a pitch to listeners as to, I mean, there's been a lot of work on volatility in recent times. We've seen people looking at extra and intra system volatility. Why do you think that this particular approach that you bring, focused on candidates, captures what electoral volatility needs to capture? Make the pitch to the readers that they should follow Sikkan Kukkah's approach rather than somebody else's.
Two things. First of all, you refer to, I mean, obviously I can draw it in your whiteboards, all the explanations, but obviously the listeners can't see it. So I need to find another way to explain it. But basically, yes, electoral volatility or the vote changes or party fortune changes between elections is a workhorse in party system studies. And you correctly refer to the important distinction between intra and extra system volatility, where intra system means that some parties that existed already before lose votes to other previously existing parties, and extra party volatility means that they are losing votes to new parties. It's a little bit more complicated than that, but that's the gist of it. But obviously, according to our approach, there are no new and old parties. Some parties are newer and others are older. There's no, strictly speaking, no extra system and intra-system volatility, even though we do have a sort of way to actually also reflect on that. But basically what we are doing is we are looking at, because we know which part of the parties running in elections is new, meaning new candidates, and how many candidates they won over or took away from previously existing parties. And then we can sort of split the vote in the previous election according to the share of these candidates. I think it's really important to acknowledge these continuities, even if the party labels disappear, because sometimes the disappearance of party labels is kind of superficial. And if you introduce these discontinuities simply because the party labels are disappearing, you end up with very high levels of volatility where there's actually little change. And that's the in pretty much all, including the volatility scores I have previously calculated myself. So I'm also attacking my own previous work there. Is that you see that there are issues because of volatility index so far has required one-to-one correspondence between parties in a pair of elections. And I think it's about time to sort of allow for more complexity, allow for more sogginess in the indices that we use. And it was really fascinating to see that once we analyzed the determinants of the volatility scores calculated based on our approach, we saw that economic development affects level of party system change as measured by electoral volatility in Eastern Europe. It's been shown to be the case in all parts of the world, except for Eastern Europe, where the effect has been elusive so far. It's been a puzzle in our corners of political science. One interpretation has always been that politics in Eastern Europe, you know, it's this sort of orientalist argument that, oh, this is the Wild East and things are simply different. The economy doesn't matter for the weird East European voters. I'm exaggerating the point a little bit, but maybe it's not the case. Maybe it's just that our measures have not so far caught up with the complexity. And so we may need to tweak the measures. Maybe it's been simply because we haven't been able to capture the effect using our existing tools. But it's always been there.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things, I mean, you mentioned your work. I would also say my own work. I mean, one of the things reading your book made me reflect on something that I've thought about a little bit in recent times is, yeah, how useful actually even a category of new party is. Now, you wrote a number of years ago about kind of genuinely new parties and drawing a categorization, quite a high bar for what would be a new party. Mm-hmm. But in a sense, one of the things that your book really brings home to me is that this is a sliding scale, and maybe, yeah, getting away from binaries of new and old, and maybe we need to be talking more generally about kind of novelty of some description rather than necessarily getting obsessed with new parties and old parties. And I'm saying this as someone who wrote a book about new parties, but I think it's good in academia to critique oneself. But do you think it's perhaps more helpful to talk about novelty than about new parties now?
I would say so, yes. At least it's a useful, different perspective. I'm not dismissing completely the idea of new parties, because when we look at our data set, some of the parties are so obviously genuinely new that I wouldn't bury the old concept. But there are so many parties where you can't really tell whether they are new or old. I mean, Philip mentioned the Sarah Wagenknecht Alliance. I mentioned Emmanuel Macron and Marsh. They don't really fit neatly into either of the categories. There's a degree of novelty in both of them, but also you can see the sort of continuation there.
Just following on from a couple of important themes that you've touched on, Alan, I wanted to ask you a little bit more about this idea of understanding what many people call splits and mergers, but you use the language of fusions and fissions, which I prefer. I think it's a much better label. That, for scholars of Central and Eastern Europe, has been often one of the big challenges, to understand party reconfigurations. And I wondered, by using your measure, what have we learned more about fissions and fusions in Central and Eastern Europe?
Yes, it's wonderful to follow the candidates behind the fissions and fusions. Fissions, we can easily distinguish between, let's talk about party splits in the sort of more conventional language, perhaps. We can differentiate between splits into two equal parts and splits where a tiny, potentially insignificant, even if I may say so, splinter splits away from a big party. So these are actually two quite different phenomena, even though technically speaking, they both qualify as splits. Likewise, with mergers, we find a few cases of equal mergers, and then we also find some mergers between elephants and mice that really doesn't change the party system that much. We can really see that very vividly by following the candidates, or measuring candidate congruence, as we call it. Also, we capture something that is, when we analyze parties as organizations or the units of analysis, something that we fail to capture there at all is collective defections, where there's no change in parties, but a group of significant politicians moves from one party to another. It can be also individual, highly prominent politicians moving, but often it's also groups of politicians moving from one to another without forming anything in between. So at this sort of superficial level, it looks like nothing changed. But actually, the change is often more significant than changes in, you know, electoral fortunes or the changes in terms of fission and fusion or splits or mergers.
And I think in the book, you use an example from Estonia to illustrate that.
Yes, but also more recently, if the listeners want to catch up with the more recent developments, just last year, the Estonian Centre Party chose a new leader, and after that, they lost more than half of the party group in the parliament. And that's an excellent example of, first of all, you know, how leadership change is actually related to candidate change, because this movement will be reflected in the candidate lists come next election. But also, it's fascinating to see that the people leaving the Centre Party, they didn't set up new groupings. Instead, they went into three different political parties. And we are not talking about, you know, rank and file of the MPs. We had the former Prime Minister and the former leader of the Centre Party leaving for Pro Patria, Conservative Party, and some other former ministers moving to other parties. So this is incredibly important in terms of party system change. But if we just focus ourselves too much on the party labels, it looks like not particularly important.
Thanks. So I want to finish by broadening out a little bit, because a couple of the things that I really like about the book is that you're not, you know, political science, academia in general tends to get focused more and more on sub-disciplines, and we tend to read more and more stuff which is just within our particular field. But I think one of the things that really comes through in your book is, firstly, that this region of Central and Eastern Europe is one that all scholars of party politics should study, because we can learn an awful lot from that region, which we can apply more broadly. You've mentioned about trends in Western Europe. But I think also a broader point, which is very interesting in the book, is the way that you draw on other disciplines, particularly from evolutionary biology. So I wondered if you could maybe say, Philip, if you can say a little bit more about the wider lessons of the book in terms of not just those who study Central and Eastern Europe, but also more broadly for scholars about the benefits of reading beyond one's, not just one's sub-discipline, but one's discipline.
Yeah. In our book now, evolution features quite prominently. It's part of the title, but it's really not what we started out with, because we looked at the paradigm that was dominant in party research, or and still is, of what we call an organizational paradigm. We look at parties as a specific type of organization, but then we realized that didn't quite fit what we were looking at. And I think sort of discovering evolutionary biology and new ways of looking at parties from that angle was really a breakthrough in the book, and how we could present our own ideas. Also discovering that even in evolutionary biology, there are analogies to political science, talking about the democratization of the cell, realizing that all different parts play a role and not just the nucleus. So I think this book can really be an example for how much value you can get out of looking into other disciplines and how they conceptualize things on a more abstract level and try to tell a story that is broadly comprehensible to a lot of people and making new sense of data. I mean, we look at Central and Eastern Europe, which definitely is treasure trove of data because we have so many different parties. We have so many different variations of fissions and fusions, of collective defections, of parties renaming themselves, disappearing and reappearing. Yeah, maybe we have a whole universe of possible changes that could still happen in other parts of the world, and maybe they are. And our laboratory, to say, in terms of genetic evolutionary genetics, is Central and Eastern Europe, but it's much more. It shows us what we might find somewhere else when we look below the surface. Especially thinking of fairly stable political parties in Western Europe that may have recently lost support but are still sort of big players, where we might miss a lot of change because we see them as these monoliths and don't look below the surface, and maybe it's just much closer to it in Central and Eastern Europe.
Absolutely. I was thinking as I was on the train this morning coming into the office, just thinking about the forthcoming election in the UK and the candidate lists for the Conservative Party and the Labour Party. And I think it would be quite an interesting exercise. There's a lot of talk about the number of Conservatives who are not going to run again. It'll be interesting to see who they get replaced with. And equally, this discussion in terms of the Labour Party talking about change that Keir Starmer wants to emphasise, it would be very interesting to apply your measures and look at the Labour Party's candidate list when it finally gets published for the forthcoming election, and looking back to 2019 and to see the extent of change. So I think absolutely the measures that you provide, I think, will be very, very useful and very helpful to scholars of Western Europe and indeed scholars more broadly. So, you know, as my frequent co-author Kevin Degenkraus often says, the future lies east. So scholars should be looking at Central and Eastern Europe and looking at great scholarship like yours in order to get insights into developments in party politics in their specific parts of the globe. I fear our time is up. I would love to keep talking with you. It's been fascinating to chat to you about the book. So I would like to thank Philip and thank Alan very much for joining the People Power Politics podcast and talking about their new book. A reminder, the book is called Party People, Candidates and Party Evolution, published by Oxford University Press. So run out to your bookstores or get online and order a copy of the book and start applying the candidate measure of party change to your part of the globe. So I'm Tim Horton, Professor of Comparative and European Politics at the University of Birmingham. It's been my pleasure to host this particular session. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the People Power Politics podcast, brought to you by CEDA, the Centre for Elections, Democracy, Accountability and Representation at the University of Birmingham. To learn more about our centre and the exciting work we do on these issues around the world, please follow us on Twitter at CEDA_BHAM and visit our website using the link in the podcast description.